Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch. I'm Sue Rocco. Joining me this week will be Elizabeth Hirsch Naftali. And Liz is a hostage advocate after her great niece was abducted by Hamas on October 7th of 2023. She has a fascinating story and is going to walk us through how her life has completely changed and how fortunately Abigail was returned home safe and sound. Don't forget to stay with us during the breaks, where you'll hear from our exclusive watch team of corporate partners who help us to bring you the show each and every week. And lastly, I invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel at W2W Media. So now I'm very honored to welcome to the show Liz Hirsch Naftali. Liz, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. And just so our viewers and listeners know, you're joining us from Israel today. Yes. And the first thing I wanted to kind of say at the top of the show before we get started, before you share a very personal and important story with all of us, is that prior to the events that took place on October 7th, 2023, you were a successful businesswoman, a philanthropist, a board member. These are things you still are today. Active, I would say, politically. You're a mother, you're a friend, you're an aunt. And so you were living life as this person, born in California. And then October 7th happened. And I thought at the very top of this show, we would I would give you an opportunity to just walk us through that day and the events that took place for you personally.
Okay. Well, first, thank you. I'm glad to be here. And, you know, it is a tough story because I grew up in California. I got married. I lived in Israel for many years. Then I moved back to the States. But I had two daughters that live in Israel that I've been visiting back and forth. And I came here on October 6th, a year ago, to visit my daughter. And I landed on a Friday evening, and I had all intentions of having a beautiful week here, and even started Friday night by going to Jerusalem and celebrating the holiday of Simchat Torah, where you dance with the Torah and you just are celebrating the end of the Torah. And for the Jewish people, that means that the next day, the next week, you start the Torah at the beginning. And so I woke up, I went, and then the next morning I woke up and there were bomb sirens, which is something that people in Israel have gotten used to, unfortunately, where they hear a siren and they run to a bomb shelter. And then 5 or 10 minutes later, when they think it's all clear, they start life again. And on this morning, on October 7th, there were a few bomb sirens and I was at a hotel and we ran to the stairwell. And I preface it with this was a normal thing. But on this morning, by the third or fourth time that we were running to the bomb shelter, we understood something was happening along the border of Israel and Gaza. And I have family that live on a community there called Kfar Aza. So I called my sister-in-law and she didn't answer. And I called my niece and she didn't answer. And so I called another relative who lives near the center of the country in Tel Aviv. And I said, what's going on? And the first thing she said to me was that my niece and her husband had been murdered that morning by Hamas terrorists that had come into their community. And they had also murdered my three-year-old great niece, Abigail. And, you know, even a year later when I say it, it's just very emotional. And so on that morning, on October 7th, a year ago, 1,200 people were murdered in Israel, most of them in their homes, burned, killed, raped, and 246 people, little kids, infants to grandparents, men, women, were kidnapped and taken as hostages into Gaza. That morning, my niece had been putting her three children into their home shelter when the bombs went off. And before she could actually put them in, Hamas terrorists came in and they murdered her in front of three children, a three-year-old, a six-year-old, and a nine-year-old. And these three children, after they saw their mother be killed, ran outside. Their father, who was a photojournalist, had gone out just a few minutes earlier to take photos of the missiles being above overhead. And because this is what he did, he's a photojournalist. And it wasn't something he had ever had that was more than just missiles. But he realized there were terrorists. He ran home. And as he was running, he met these kids and he picked up the three-year-old little girl named Abigail. And he started running with her with the two other kids by his side. And he was gunned down and killed by terrorists. The 6 and 9-year-old saw their father get killed. They assumed their sister had been killed. And these two little kids ran to their home, locked themselves in a closet where they stayed for 14 hours before they could be evacuated. What ended up happening was there were so many, this is a community of about 650 people that day. And there were about 300 terrorists that had arrived there. And Abigail had been under her father. But what we learned a few days later, once they finally realized what had happened, that she had actually crawled out from her father's body, covered in his blood, and gone to a neighbor, a family that she knew. And just by chance, the husband had been going outside. He was protecting the kibbutz, and he saw this little girl who he knew. And he brought her inside and put her with his wife and three kids. And he went out to protect the kibbutz, this community they lived on. And he was injured and did not come back. And what we learned a few days later was that the Hamas terrorists had come into this home and taken this woman and her three children and my niece, Abigail, my great niece, into Gaza in this woman's car. And they disappeared as hostages. So they were five of the 246 people who were kidnapped that morning in Israel.
So that's an incredibly horrific, tragic, awful story. And something that I wanted to ask you at the very beginning, because I think it's really interesting. I, of course, read the book that you just released, and I wanted to show Abigail's picture.
Thank you.
And this was interesting to me. Throughout the whole book, you lay out the story and then your life after, which now you've become a very active hostage advocate. And fortunately for you, you've had ties to people in high places. And we'll kind of talk about that. But just something that struck me from the very beginning, aside from despair and distraught and fear and just being probably feeling frozen in time, I never heard you use the word anger, I don't think, in the book or in speaking. And when I read it, being a mother, not having ever experienced anything closely related to what you've been through, I was born and raised here in America. I don't know that I could get past the anger. And I wonder if how you do that.
It's a really good question. And, you know, when I learned that Abigail was a hostage, my first thought was, how do we get this child out? How do I do something to help? And, you know, in the beginning, I think there was this feeling that this wouldn't last, that they would be released, these hostages. That's like my, it's my first inclination, I think many people's. And then what we realized was they weren't going to be released. And so my first piece was, how do we get this child out? And I took that picture, which is on the cover of the book, Saving Abigail. And I printed that picture and I went to Capitol Hill and I went to as many places. I did a lot of interviews. I did a lot of press. And what I did was I gave everybody, literally from the camera person to the page, to the people working in the offices, to the leaders. And by the way, Republicans, Democrats, anyone that would listen. And we, in the beginning, I was one of the only people who was already back in America. Because after this happened, people said, go back to America, tell the story. You'll do more good for this situation, this horrific, tragic day in America than being in Israel. And so I just went to this like fight or flight moment, which was like, how do we do this? And, you know, there's no roadmap for something like this. This has not been, this has not happened before. And I took this picture and I just went and I told the story. And at that point, there wasn't time for anger. There was just time for like, how do we get this child? And then other children and women and men, how do we get them out? So I took this picture of Abigail. And then I took another picture that had 246 faces of all the people that were kidnapped that day. And you know, it's interesting because on that day, my niece, an American, and her husband, an Israeli, were both murdered. They were of 1,200 people murdered. And you didn't even have time to like start to think about what that meant because there was a child, a little, little girl, this beautiful child to save. And so you just, I went into this moment of like, I am going to do anything I can. And I saw her picture I put on my desk. And I kept looking at it and I looked at these eyes and I said, I'm going to bring you home. I don't know how, but I'm going to bring you home. And so, you know, at that moment and throughout that 51 days when she was a hostage, I didn't have time for anger. I just had time to fight to get her out and as many other people as I could. And at the end of November, 105 women and children were released over a shorter than a week period in a peaceful ceasefire. So there was no fighting and they released these women and children. Then they stopped and there were still a lot of people left that were hostages. And then I went into this, okay, you know, on October 7th, I woke up and all of these people that were hostages, their families became my family. And so even though Abigail and the women and children were released, my belief was we're still in this together. And here we are today, and this has been over a year. So about 300, and I think it's about 380 days today. There's still 101 people who are hostages in Gaza. And so I say that to you to give you this understanding of like, there's still this fight to get these people out. And I'm still participating with so many others here in Israel and in America. So going back to your original question about anger and being mad, the one thing that I understand is that there's been a lot of revisionism of what happened on October 7th. And to this day, it's really important. And that's why I wrote this book, to really set the record clear of what happened on October 7th. For me, that was important. And then I looked at these people and I thought to myself, like, there's so much anger we kept hearing. I have to tell you, Sue, there were so many beautiful things that happened and so many people that were sending their love and fighting for Abigail and fight still to this day for all the hostages and people from the Jewish community, the evangelical Christian community, the Buddhist community, the Muslim community. I mean, we got people from all over the world that were just saying, we're here for you. So that was really heartwarming. And I'll just say this piece, which is, you know, one person reached out to me who's been helping me and she said, I don't understand why you still have love in your heart at this moment. This was a few months ago. And I said to her, because she said, I can't, just like you were sort of saying. And I thought to myself, like, there's still women and children who are hostages. And one of the things that I've always said is that if you were to release these hostages and cease this fighting, because there's incredible fighting going on in this region, and actually help the people that are living, the women, the children, the people, the Palestinians that are living in Gaza, we could actually make this world a better place for them. And so there was not time for anger. There was just this time for like, if I can spread love and I can share this, maybe this will help others. And, you know, to get entrenched in anger, we see what that does. That continues the fighting. Yeah. But I think as women and as people who can, you know, rise above it, there's this place where we can actually make a difference. And it does start with using love and not hate and not anger, but also telling the truth about the situation.
Right. I think that's really important. So many people really don't know the truth behind certainly what's happening in the Middle East and for thousands of years, right? We're always searching and reading and trying to learn and be educated and know what's really happening. I have a quote, and this, I guess, was something you were thinking about in the very beginning. You said, I had no idea how to move the entire American federal government amid an unprecedented geopolitical mess. But I knew that America was still the most powerful force on earth. And having gone through just this past year, it's only been a year. It's not a long time, right? Do you still feel that? Do you still believe that? Are you even more, have more resolve?
So, yes, because I'll go back to what I said earlier, which is I came back to the States and I, with a certain group of families that were in the States, started going to the Congress and started having these conversations with our leaders. And what I found was that we had bipartisan support from Republicans and Democrats, really the majority. And that was really important because we've heard so much discourse and now there's an election season. But even in general, you see Democrats and Republicans entrenched on different sides and not coming together publicly for really important things. And we had that support. And that was something very special about America, which was they all came together. They understood this was a humanitarian crisis, that terrorism, no matter where in the world, is something that we fight against as Americans. But we also fight against it in Israel because Israel is our ally in the Middle East. There's all kinds of discussions that can be had around that. Like I say, this geopolitical nightmare. But at the end of the day, when you talk about 246 people kidnapped, children and adults, and you talk about the amount of people that were mass murdered and raped, you just understand that, like, America came together. And I will also say the following was that President Biden and Vice President Harris and their administration really, they came and they said, we are going to fight to get these hostages back. We are going to do everything we can. And, you know, it's very interesting because I was connected and I did have connections. But what I realized was most of the people that I was meeting early on were people that had reached out to me and said, I will take you to Capitol Hill. I will make these meetings for you. I met this woman who I talk about in the book named Penny Nance from Concerned Women for America. And I bring it up because this is a woman's program and we talk about diversity of women. And this woman, very different than I am, very different background. She calls herself a hillbilly, but she is just a really smart, very conservative, but really well connected in the political world in DC. And she opened my eyes and invited me to meetings with Republicans and women leaders and people that I would have never had an opportunity to meet. Mm-hmm. And her heart has been in it all the days up to leading to Abigail's release. And to this day, she has been an advocate and an ally to myself and so many of our families. And so when you ask, like, America, that shows who we are. We come together at these moments. And I'll just say, you know, for a year, the hostage families, the American hostage families, there's still 7 Americans that are being held. There were 12 that were taken that day. But one of the things that we had early on was the support of the U.S. government, the president, President Biden, Vice President Harris, and their administration. And we have had meetings with the president, meeting with the vice president. And keep in mind, President Biden came to Israel during the fighting very early on, trying to, you know, show leadership. And one of the things that I know very clearly is that he led the moment that Abigail and 105 women and children were released. If it weren't for the American leadership, the president of the United States and the vice president, I actually have thought, and I've talked with many people who wonder what would have happened with this 3-year-old little girl named Abigail and these 105 women and children. And I am very clear that one of the other parts that's really important is that it's not America alone, but it's when you have a strong America, an America that works with allies and works with people in the Middle East, like the Qataris and the Egyptians, who helped to make this hostage deal happen and continue to work with people like the Egyptian leadership and the Qatari leadership, then we can move forward. And so when you ask, like, do I still believe in America and believe that America is an amazing country and can do amazing things? I do, because I see their leadership. And look, I've been here now in Israel for over almost 2 weeks, and we're still running to bomb shelters. And 2 weeks ago, 200 missiles came in from Iran into Israel, but not just into Israel, heading for the center of Israel, for Tel Aviv, and to military compounds. And it was America that led, President Biden and Vice President Harris and their team, that actually led this group of Europeans, the UK, the French, the Saudis, the Jordanians, and others to help Israel. And so I look at it and I say, I'm so blessed to be an American, and I'm so proud to be an American. And while we still haven't gotten all the hostages out, I know that it's the leadership of the U.S. government that had made Abigail's release possible and keeps that possibility of not only getting the rest of the hostages out, but finding solutions that are diplomatic to end the fighting here. And, you know, at the end of all fighting, Sue, there is diplomacy. The goal is to get it done before too many people's lives are lost. And I believe that is the goal of our country and of our leadership.
Does it make you wonder something like this? Why does it always take a major tragedy to bring people together? Why can't that be a regular way of conversing, debating, trying to get to the truth of matters and trying to find solutions?
I don't know the answer. I just know that it shouldn't be that way. But when you get to that place, and, you know, I was before this, as you described, like doing my thing, helping other people. I never was in a position of needing to ask for this desperate help or being with a group of people, especially a lot of these Israeli families that were coming. And I'll talk about this, which is, you know, after the first few weeks, what we saw was many families coming from Israel, people who lost loved ones in this fighting, lost loved ones on October 7th, and had their family members as hostages in Gaza. And what I saw was they were able also, not Americans, but to go out and meet with our leaders and to make meetings with Republicans and Democrats and tell their stories. And that's pretty special about America. Now, they've gone to other countries and that's been very special, but they've also had this real like root of being able to have these conversations with America. And the thing that I will say, which is important to give texture to this, is that these hostage families, they represented originally over 30 countries. These were people who were dual citizens. So these were people from European nations, South American, Asian, Middle Eastern. They were Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, Thai, Jewish. So they were all this very diverse group of people. And they all could come to America and ask for this help. And so I don't know why it takes something so tragic and so horrible, but what I do know is that this response that we had from this has been unifying and has made it very clear that this is what we do. We stand for freedom. And when we see that freedom and rights are taken away, as America, we come together. And so I don't have the answer of why it takes this, but what I do hope is that from this moment, we don't go back, but we go forward and we figure out how to keep working together to bring peace in this nation, in this region, because there isn't peace right now. Yeah. And I just hope that we use this terrible situation to, one, bring home the hostages, stop the fighting, help the people that are living in Gaza, but to help this region, because Abigail, whose picture you showed, I don't want her to be sitting on a screen like you and I are right now and having to have this conversation in, you know, in the years to come.
Right. You know, Liz, something that's fascinating to me, and this, you know, kind of leads me to my question for you of what a typical day looks like for you when you're actively working as an advocate, is how in the world does one peaceful human being negotiate with a terrorist? So, and this is so multi-leveled and complicated, I understand. But when I just think about a sit down, how can that take place? Where does one even begin? And so kind of tell me what we don't know about what is actively being done to get the rest of the hostages released.
Well, it goes back to your last question, which is leadership. And how do we push for this leadership to here in Israel and in Gaza? And it's so complicated, but I think it narrows down to this concept of the humanity of the moment. And, you know, we all believe that you need diplomacy. And then your question is really good. One side is Israel and one side is Hamas. And unfortunately, Hamas is a terrorist organization. And so you say to yourself, wait, we're negotiating with a terrorist organization. But they are, and we go back to like the history, they are the leadership and they are those that were elected. And they are the ones that run Gaza. And so you really still need to put the pressure on them because they are the ones holding the hostages. But America then works with their allies or those nations that they can negotiate with, which is at this point has really been the Qataris, leadership by the prime minister there and his team, the Egyptians. And then you also then go to the Israeli side and you deal with their leadership and you deal with intelligence on both sides. When I say you deal with them, this is what the Americans can do. And it's this understanding, and I know this is complicated, but it's this understanding of how do you talk to the Israelis and get political will from their leadership to bring home these hostages and make a deal while Israel must protect itself and be safe and secure. And it's been rough for that, but we know that's really what Israel must do. But in that same breath, Israel must also find a way, and that's the prime minister and his leadership, to bring home their people. And I'll get to a little bit of that after. But then you need to go to the Hamas side. And Israel, America doesn't deal with Hamas directly. They deal with the Qataris, the Egyptians. By the way, they deal with the Saudis. They deal with the Emirates. They deal with the Turks. They deal with the Jordanians, anybody and everyone that can put pressure on Hamas. And so when you ask this question, it's so complicated, but what I try to remind everybody and why I'm talking to you and why I wrote the book Saving Abigail is because at this moment, it's about the hostages. And, you know, you talked about like it's been a year, but it's been a year where people are being held in atrocious conditions. And 40 days ago, six young people, one was a young man named Hirsch Goldberg Poland, an American Israeli, and he was executed by Hamas. And five other young Israelis were executed. There have been other executions of older Israelis and older people. And there haven't been a lot of people that have been released since the end of November. And so you say to yourself, like, what can we keep doing? And it goes back to that while we're in this war time and while we see all this fighting, what I know is that President Biden, Vice President Harris, the Qataris, the Egyptians, and so many other groups are trying to put that pressure to bring political will from Prime Minister Netanyahu and from Sinwar, who is the leader of Hamas. And I don't think I actually answered your question succinctly, but I tried to bring together all these elements of this work. And even as we speak, there are still people in the U.S. government working with people in the Israeli government, working with leaders in Egypt and Qatar and with Hamas through them to still bring a deal. And so even amidst this conversation, people are still trying to figure out how to piece together a ceasefire hostage release deal because nobody can sit back and just say, let's just see what happens. And right. All of this goes back to these hostages. And, you know, just to add one piece, which is, for Israel to be able to move forward as a nation, as a society, these 100 people need to come home. And for the people in Gaza to move forward, we need these people to come home so that the fighting can stop and they can get humanitarian aid and they can have peace and security. And so it is very complicated, but it all starts with the hostages being released.
So I would imagine that your whole focus is to bring those people home. There's a lot going on around them and in all of the countries and people's views on the best way to move forward. But your belief is that the only option for the possibility of peace there is for the hostages to be released. And then further conversations can be had. I have so many questions around, I guess, the morality of, you know, negotiations really means we will do this for you and you will do this for us, right? And it's hard to come to grips with, gosh, do you do for someone who is not deserving? But the reality is it's the only way.
Yeah, and there's two points I'll bring. One is, you know, as American hostage families, we've also sat down with National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, I think 14 times.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Many times at the White House, other times virtually. And with Brett McGurk, who is the negotiator for the Middle East on behalf of the U.S., who goes and meets with the different parties. And we've sat down with CIA Director Bill Burns and with Secretary of State Blinken. And so there is this thing which is so interesting, and I write about it in the book, which is like people don't know who these people are. They just know they have titles. But what I try to do is to humanize them so that people could understand that the leadership in America are real people. And, you know, we've seen people like Jake Sullivan actually tear up on talking about hostages or talking about the death of Americans, and knowing while they're doing these intricate, incredible, hard jobs, that these are humans that actually have a heart and are caring about what they're doing. And then the other piece is, and I think about this, which is, and I go back to the people that are living in Gaza, they aren't Hamas terrorists. They're human beings that just basically want to go home at the end of the day, just like you as a mother with your children, and give them love and embrace them. And I look at Israel and I say the same thing. There's so many people in Israel, and what they just want to do is have normal lives. And so what I keep going back to is like, how do we remind people this is a humanitarian crisis? And these are real people. The hostages are real people. If you just say hostages, you don't realize there's two little kids, babies that are still there. And so I just keep focusing on how do we make it better for human beings? And I think that is really, and I mean this greatly, the priority of the U.S. government. It is the priority of the Middle Eastern governments, the Gulf governments that are doing this work, which is how do we bring these people back to like, these are real people. And I'll say something that's also really interesting. We've had myself and other hostage families, Americans and Israelis, we've been invited to meetings with the Prime Minister of Qatar, with the negotiating team of Qatar, both in Doha, Qatar, and in DC and in New York. And think about this. There's never been something like this where a Middle Eastern Gulf nation like Qatar has actually not only negotiating, which is what they do a lot of this hostage negotiating work, but they have sat with these families and they have sat in their pain. And these are people that you think are just, who are they? But at the end of the day, they're fathers. There's not a lot of mothers, so there's not a lot of women on those sides I like to bring in. But these are parents. And they meet with these families. We haven't been able to meet with other nations, the Egyptians and the Saudis and the Jordanians and others. They haven't agreed to meet with us. But the Qataris have. And I bring that up so that listeners, because I know that women and people are listening around the world, that is pretty unique. Think about it, which is something which I hope that when I talk about, like, how do we see a future? You know, there's the Abraham Accords, which include Middle Eastern nations and Israel. How do we build upon that? How do we include the Palestinian people? How do we include other nations? How do we get the Middle East to be a functioning, cooperative, not everyone has to love each other, but to work together to make this region both productive, but safe and secure for all the people? And I believe that that's part of my passion. But it does, again, I go back to, it starts with the release of the hostages that were stolen that day.
Yeah. Listen, we have to go into a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about your own podcast and what you're doing in these conversations with leaders, and then the book, and a little bit more about just the work that you're doing today and how the listeners and viewers can be of help to you. Stay with us as we go into our break, and I'll be back with Elizabeth Hirsch Naftali. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Christy McCaffrey. I'm the founder and owner of Be The Good Media, and I'm here to share some good news with you. Today, I wanted to share with you about a woman who is truly doing meaningful and impact-driven work in her community. Her name is Corinne O'Connell. Corinne is the CEO of Habitat for Humanity Philadelphia. And as CEO, Corinne and her team work to make sure that every person in our city has a decent place to live. I was truly inspired in speaking with Corinne on my show because it was just so clear how passionate she is about making a meaningful impact in her community and in the lives of those she serves, not just today, but for many more years to come. You can hear more of my conversation with Corinne at BeTheGoodMedia.com, and there you will also learn more about how Be The Good Media helps to amplify impact-driven missions and causes. Again, I'm Christy McCaffrey. Stay tuned here on Women to Watch Media for more good news.
Ladies, I'm Tiffany Curtin, a financial professional with more than 25 years of experience serving successful women, families, and businesses. Here's the reality. You don't have to be the one managing your family's finances to take ownership of your future. But if you want true confidence about how everything is going to play out, you do have to take part in the process. That doesn't mean digging into the weeds of your finances when you don't have the time or desire. It means elevating your awareness of your own circumstances. It means having the bigger conversations so you're empowered when you need to be. Let's bring confidence to your family's future without overwhelming your time. Call myself at 903-520-2709. That's 903-520-2709, or visit Johnson Financial Group on our website, www.jfg.cc, not .com, www.jfg.cc.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 executives through my work at the EXCO Group, firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior leaders grow. Today on Leadership Watch, we're going to talk about being in the driver's seat of your career. No matter what stage you're at in your career, you need to grasp that you are in the driver's seat. Understanding from day one that you and you alone are responsible for your career is critical. After all, why would you hand your career over to someone else to manage? There's no one as vested in yourself as you. And the ugly truth is that most managers are focused on execution rather than team development. So how can you ensure that your career stays on track? First, make sure you have a clear set of agreed upon goals that are measurable, and if priorities shift, rewrite them with buy-in. Two, if you see something that can be improved upon or automated, don't wait to be asked, just do it. This is good advice for tech-savvy millennials and Gen Zs who can help lead the way with AI. Three, don't insulate yourself. Get to know other parts of the organization and network both internally and externally. Feel free to drive outside of your lane. And four, while your career is yours to own, don't go it alone. Identify sponsors and mentors. Also, it's important to make self-reflection and self-assessment a habit. Think through where you want to be 5 years from now and create a roadmap for yourself. Does your current path get you there? Are you passionate about what you're doing? Do you feel challenged? Are you learning? Do you feel respected? And importantly, are you a cultural fit? And is the company a cultural fit for you? If you answer negative to any of these questions, it's likely time for some course correcting. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, check out expoleadership.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the show. I'm speaking this week with Elizabeth Hirsch Naftali, and Elizabeth is a hostage advocate after her own family suffered from the attacks on October 7th, 2023, and Hamas abducted Liz's great niece, Abigail. And in the first segment, Liz, we talked a lot about the human side of war and negotiations, and of course, always searching for ways to for all of us to live peacefully. And something you're doing is you have your own podcast, and you're having conversations that go behind the titles of political leaders. So I think it's great, and I'd love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about it.
So my podcast is called The Capital Coffee Connection. And I actually started this June of 2023. And what I realized was, you know, I was doing a lot of work, and my main goal over many years was to help elect women leaders. I just felt like we needed the woman's voice. And I spent a lot of time doing that, and also just trying to help elect and share stories of women leaders and of people that were not represented. So minorities and people that I just felt needed a voice in our politics. And while many of them were Democrats, what I realized early on, and especially with just hearing that we weren't talking to each other and that we were entrenched and we were divided, I thought, wow, wouldn't it be interesting to have a podcast that just talked to leaders, both Democrats and Republicans, about their heart and their humanity, their stories, who they are, but not to talk about politics and policy. So when I did the Capital Coffee Connection, my goal was to keep something that was green and so that you could get to learn about our elected leaders. And, you know, I grew up in a family where my mother was always trying to tell me the background of leaders didn't matter, Democrat or Republican, the countries they came from, their religions. It was really interesting to her. And so I thought, wow, this would be an interesting opportunity. And so the summer before everything happened on October 7th, I launched this podcast and just started talking with different leaders. And I thought, you know, what is it that brings us together? And the things that I was really going to was like, where were they from? Were they born in America or were they immigrants? What kind of family lives did they have? And a big question that I found so much connectivity on was teachers, like who motivated them, who inspired them, and even things like their favorite ice cream flavor or their favorite exercise or their favorite household chore. And I asked men and women, diverse, everyone. And after October 7th, you know, Sue, I had set them into, I had done a bunch of interviews and we put them out. And then I really stopped until the spring of 2024 because all I did was focus on these hostages. But what I was realizing is that parallel to this, I was going in and having meetings with very diverse leaders. And I was realizing everything that this podcast was trying to accomplish, you know, was unfortunately shown in this moment of, like you said, why does it sometimes take something so horrific to bring us together or to wake us up? And I thought, wow, here it is that it's actually coming together, this idea of like, we have so much more in common. And I'll use this one example, is that one of the meetings I had early on when Abigail was a hostage was with Steve Scalise, Republican, far right. And I didn't know anything about him other than he was just somebody that was a leader of the Republican Party and different in many views than I had. And then I went and met a couple times early on and then with a group of others with Hakeem Jeffries, the leader of the Democratic Party. And again, two gentlemen very, very far apart in terms of the politics and policy. But what I learned by interviewing both of them, because I went to them after Abigail was released and I was back to doing the podcasts, and I met with them within a week of each other. And here I was with two men who had really opened up their heart and done what they could to be as leaders of two parties to help the all the hostage families. But what I learned was they both loved their wives. They both had two children. They both were dedicated to spending time with their families. And they both had incredibly beautiful stories about growing up and being Americans and being proud. And what I found was they had so much more in common. And it was interesting because I put them out one after the other. And it was a really good way for people to see why this was important. And I had seen Leader Jeffries a few weeks after, and I said to him, wow, you know, I met with Steve Scalise and I met with you, and it was really great to have both of you because I know you're very different. And he looked at me, goes, I like Steve Scalise. He's a good guy. We disagree on many things, but he is a good person. And I think, Sue, that's why I started this. And I hope to continue it, just because I think as we move forward, no matter what happens in the elections, what I really want is for us to understand that our elected leaders are humans, and we actually have more in common as humans, and that should bring us together versus divide us.
Yes. I love that you're doing that. I love it. And I've been trying to tune into some of them because it's very similar to what I do here.
Yes.
Although this is a show for women, I think that, you know, some of the greatest lessons are when someone speaks about who they are and their beliefs and where they came from, as opposed to just the work that they do. So I think it's fascinating to get that. And were these leaders eager to sit with you and tell these personal stories? Or did you have to kind of pull it out of them a little?
You know, no. And it's so interesting because they almost come to it a little bit skeptical. Like, what has she got planned? And there's no gotcha question, because I don't want to have a gotcha question. And
right.
We also realize is that as many issues that you consider politics and policy, which are just people share them in common, which is their what we need as human beings. And so as opposed to like how someone voted, if you talk about how they believe, what you see is that they believe really similar things about the freedom of America, the benefits of things that we get as a country that has a democracy, but also just this understanding of like, I go back to the teachers, like who mentored us? And there's all these teachers in it. And when these leaders get to talk about their teachers and who inspired them, and in some cases, who made sure they had dinner that night, who made sure that when they were, you know, on the weekends that they were invited to come and do certain things so that they knew these families didn't have the capacity to take care of their kids. And one of the things that I just think is so beautiful is that when we're done with them, they basically Republicans, Democrats, doesn't matter what their religion is or what their background is, they basically say, thank you. Like, that was just a great opportunity, because if you think about sound bites in our news, they've got 2 minutes, 3 minutes on a CNN, Fox, MSNBC, whatever, to get their policy out, to get their story out. But they never get time to just kind of delve into who they are.
Right.
And the podcast gives them that opportunity. So it's almost like a, not a therapy session, but sort of a sharing session, like just like having actually coffee with them. And I've been able to do many in person where we had coffee, and others like you and I are doing, which is virtual. But it's connecting. You and I are having a conversation. You're asking me questions, but you're asking me questions so you can learn and, you know, and have this conversation so people who are listening can also feel like they're sort of involved in this moment with us.
Yes. Well, before I let you go, the last thing I want to do is try to kind of connect the dots between the little girl that you were and the work you're doing today. And I'm sure you never imagined ever that you would be doing this. I loved reading that, you know, as a little girl, you dreamt of being an actor. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because you are, you know, publicly speaking, and, you know, you're doing interviews in some major networks and speaking to some very powerful people. Go back to that little girl who wanted to be an actor. Where did that come from?
I just loved acting, and I spent a lot of time in high school doing shows and producing and performing. And I just thought, you know, I loved being on a stage. But what I also realized was, you know, once I finished college, and what I really wanted to do was to, you know, I didn't want to have to be a starving actress, to be honest with you. I wanted to know that I could work. And my father, when I was 13, he was like, okay, it's time to start working, you know? And so on my holidays and my weekends, just like many people, and again, going back to my podcast, you hear about these young people that these leaders now, but when they were like in their teen years, were already working. And what I learned was, if you work hard and you make money, it feels good. And so because of my experience growing up and in high school and in college, always working, when I finished college, I was like, okay, I'm good at working. I'm going to keep working. I loved acting. But then I just found like, okay, I can be so productive and I can help others. Like you said, I was on I'm on boards and I was participating in so many things. And I realized that through my efforts, I could help others and I could do all this stuff. And I liked that role. I didn't really at that point as an adult want to be in the forefront. I was raising my kids. I was trying to, you know, have a good life. And I didn't feel like, oh, I'm missing something. But then when I was put in this horrific situation and woke up one day and I said, oh my God, I have this little child that I'm trying to save. I kind of thought like maybe everything that I had done in my life, whether it was acting in high school, playing sports in high school, or, you know, living in Israel for many years, learning a new language, working really hard, building businesses, both in America and in Israel, raising all my kids, maybe, and helping elect people, but never being the one to be elected. And I, you know, one of the things I always said was like, I want to help people get elected, but I just don't want to get involved in the politics because that wasn't who I was. But maybe, you know, Sue, there's something that, and I've listened to some of the people you've spoken with before where they look back and they say something got me here where I am today. And it's something that builds and why we could look back and say, hey, it didn't go the way I expected it to, or something changed. But everything builds to who we are. And especially I think as women, we wake up one day and we say, okay, I know my power. I know who I am. And I always felt like I was sort of that person. I just was sort of in the background, but waking up and being in this position of trying to save Abigail and other people and save lives, I just thought, wow, maybe this is what everything in my life until this moment set me to be in this exact moment to do.
Yes.
And I don't know if that resonates with you or the listeners, but that's kind of where my head has been in the last weeks as I'm sort of evaluating this year and thinking like, I never imagined on October 6, 2023, that I would be in this position. But here I am a year later and feeling like, maybe it was all meant so that in this unfortunate, tragic moment, I could be the leader that I've become and an advocate and working with so many others. And I'll give you this last piece, which is learning to listen really well, learning to find love, because we talked about that, and to not be so quick to judge, but to really, and I think this is something that many women do well, which is how to work with others to find solutions in the most difficult times, or when people have said, we've already tried it, it didn't work, but just to keep pushing, but to keep pushing in a way that is thoughtful and inclusive, but it starts with knowing who you are as a woman and understanding what's important. And I think that's sort of where I am. And, you know, I appreciate this time with you because for me, you know, I talk about like when the people, you know, the leaders that I interview leave, they feel like they've been able to share and it's therapeutic and it makes them feel really like, wow, this was important. Having this conversation with you for me is really important because it is still a struggle and it is still really hard days. And when I retell the story of what happened to Abigail and my niece Smadar that day and the murder, and I spend time with my sister-in-law who lost her daughter and my niece whose sister, her best friend was gone, you need that strength and you need that strength to keep fighting. And it comes from these moments where you can connect and share the story. But it's hard. And so I just want to say thank you for giving me this opportunity and really just reminding our listeners. And it goes back to there are still 100 people being held hostage. Some of them are American. There are young women who have been raped and abused. There are young men. There are grandparents. There's little kids. And I would just hope that people listening in America or ever they are in the world would tell Abigail's story, tell the hostage story. And in whatever communities they are, push that we can have a ceasefire, push that we can release these hostages, and push that we can help people on both sides. Because that should be the story, which is how do we make a difference? Which is bring home the hostages, stop the fighting, and help the people living in Gaza and the people living in Israel and in the region.
Yes. And keep talking about it. Keep talking about it.
Bearing witness, talking about it.
Yes. I appreciate so much, Liz, your time. And I am certainly going to share the book and will be following your work, praying, encouraging, and just really feeling grateful that your family has you as a leader there to have helped bring Abigail home, and now for all of the other families that you're helping. So
yeah, thank you. And by the way, the book Saving Abigail tells Abigail's story, but what it really does is it tells a story of fighting for her, fighting for others, and it tells people who may be going like, let me share this with other people. This book, whether it's heard or read, is really this call to action, and that we all can come together. And I end this book by saying, we haven't completed our work and we Correct. Need everybody to help us. So thank Yes. you.
I think it's incredibly educational as well. Yeah. The book is just beautifully written. You go through all of the emotions, but I learned a lot from it too. Just, you know, about our government and you know, politics and policy and how things get done, which I think is important, you know, to understand, keeps us from making judgments about things we really don't understand.
Yes. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah. Congratulations. We're going to go into our last break and I'll be back to close out the show. Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has long been ranked as one of the best children's hospitals in the country. In our Women to Watch at CHOP series, we'll meet the women working to preserve this best-in-class pediatric innovation. Let's meet Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, Sophia Holder. Sophia, just take a minute to kind of introduce yourself to our guests. Tell them a little bit about where you came from and how you ended up in this role.
Yes, and thank you, Susan, for just the amazing work that you do to inspire women leadership. I would still call myself as new to CHOP. Started just over 3 years ago, and I'm honestly in my dream job in an organization that is focused on delivering and innovating care for children. And so it's hard not to find joy in that space. My career in healthcare spans many years, starting in the adult side and now on the pediatric side. And I'm just really thrilled to be with you today.
What advice would you have for our listeners and our viewers listening to you today?
So I would offer two pieces of advice. Focus on continuous learning. Be a life learner. That's the frame that I often use with those who work with me and for me. Stay updated on industry trends. Continuously seek opportunities for learning and growth. Knowledge is power in any leadership role. I think the other piece of advice I would give is model authenticity. Be authentic and true to yourself. Authentic leadership builds trust and loyalty among your team and your peers, foundational to building effective teams and supporting cross-collaboration and partnership.
Thanks so much to Sophia Holder for joining us. Stay tuned for more Women to Watch at CHOP.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. Three state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level one trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first-of-its-kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. What an incredible story and conversation with Liz. I hope you enjoyed it. Next week, I'll be sitting down with Mara Smith. And Mara is the founder and CEO of Inspiro Tequila. She's also a huge advocate for women in leadership. Thanks, as always, to our sponsors and our Watch team for helping us to bring you the show each and every week. I hope you have a great week, and I'll see you next time.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your time and expertise are valuable, making focus one of the most important resources to have at work. These days, professionals spend nearly half the work week on written communication, and it can be difficult to stay on task with all the emails and documents you have to get through. With Grammarly as your AI writing partner, you can stay focused and quickly get through your work with relevant, real-time suggestions wherever you write. It works across 500,000 apps and websites, so it can help with everything, from brainstorming presentation ideas to sounding more confident and persuasive in emails and reports. For 15 years, Grammarly has offered best-in-class communication support and enterprise-grade security on a business model that doesn't sell your data. 93% of professionals report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's Grammarly.com/podcast.